Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 278 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. And in this podcast, I'm going to be talking about a super high-yield topic for all the USMLE exams, actually. Like, this is just one of these things. I can pretty much guarantee you're going to get a few questions on this on your test, regardless of what you do. And this is the podcast on amenorrhea, okay? Amenorrhea. So, what is amenorrhea? So, amenorrhea basically means you're not having your period anymore, right? You're not having your period anymore. And, I mean, obviously, if you're over the age of 40, you know, you're beginning to think of things like perimenopause or menopause. Or, I don't know, maybe as a woman, you're trying to play a prank on your husband that, oh, I miss my period, just to, you know, freak him out a bit. Whatever, I'm just kidding there. Or you're pregnant. Remember, the most common cause of secondary amenorrhea, and I'll talk about what primary amenorrhea is versus secondary amenorrhea. So let's stop joking and let's get right to it. So amenorrhea, again, it means no period, right? So what are some big things about amenorrhea? Well, you can divide amenorrhea into being primary amenorrhea or secondary amenorrhea. Right. So what's primary amenorrhea? Primary amenorrhea means you've never had menses, right? You've literally never had menses. The only thing, though, with primary amenorrhea is you need to know some age definitions. So, for example, if you have secondary sexual characteristics and you have no menses, we can wait till the age of 16 before we can diagnose you with primary amenorrhea. But if you have no secondary sexual characteristics, then unfortunately, you need to we need to be a little more aggressive. So that's the age of 14, right? So that's primary amenorrhea. Now, so again, to recap, primary amenorrhea, you don't have secondary sexual characteristics and you've not had menses. We diagnose you at 14. You have secondary sexual characteristics. We'll give you a little more leeway. You go till the age of 16. And then what is secondary amenorrhea? Secondary amenorrhea is basically a person that has had periods before, but for whatever reason, the periods stop, right? So in the case of a woman that used to have regular periods before, if she has no periods for like 3 months, that's going to be secondary amenorrhea. But if we have a woman that has had irregular periods all along, so let's say like a PCOS patient, and then she has no periods for like 6 months, then we absolutely begin to worry about secondary amenorrhea. So again, pay attention to time frames. Secondary amenorrhea means, oh, you used to have periods before, but now no more periods. If your periods were regular before, then we say if you missed 3 cycles, that's kind of worrisome, right? If your periods were irregular before, like a PCOS patient, and then you miss 6 cycles, then it's like, okay, this is really worrisome, right? And 6 cycles is usually like 6 months. 3 cycles is usually like 3 months, roughly, right? So what are some things that can cause amenorrhea? So there's a bunch, right? And the thing I will try to do here today is to try to give you a mechanism so that you're not memorizing these things. Because to be honest with you, these are really not things you should memorize. These are things you really should try to understand. So let's talk about some causes of primary amenorrhea, right? So what if they give you a question about a 4-foot-tall female and she's never had menses, right? Again, the fact that she's 4-foot-tall should tell you something, right? This person has Turner syndrome. Remember, Turner syndrome, those people genetically, they are 46X O, right? So these people, they have no bar body. If you were to look at their cells under electron microscopy, especially the nucleus. So in Turner syndrome, they have streak ovaries, right? And again, these kids, they will have like relatively normal genitalia, right? But again, they will have like really big time delay of puberty, right? Really big time delay of puberty. So essentially, because these people have streak ovaries, they're not making estrogen, right? So if you're not making estrogen, then guess what? What's going to happen to your FSH and LH? Well, your FSH, LH, and GnRH is all going to be increased, right? In fact, Turner syndrome is one of those things that causes what we know as hypergonadotropic hypogonadism, right? So your FSH, LH is elevated, but your estrogen is low, right? So they are hypergonadotropic. Their gonadotropins are high, but they are hypogonadal, right? Their estrogen is low. Another thing that can cause primary amenorrhea can also be a person that, let's say they give you a question about like a 19-year-old female. They tell you that she has never had her menses. And they tell you that she has like Turner stage 4 breasts. So, you know, she has pretty legit breasts. But then they tell you that, oh, she has no axillary or pubic hair. And then they tell you that, that her vagina ends in a blind pouch and you can't see any uterus on a transvaginal ultrasound. Whenever you see stuff like that, right, you want to think about testicular feminization syndrome, right? Remember, sometimes this is what's known as AIS, androgen insensitivity syndrome. So what's the pathophysiology there? Well, the pathophys is essentially the testosterone receptor doesn't work. It's actually like an X-linked defect. So essentially the androgen receptor doesn't work. So even if testosterone binds to it, you're not going to be able to respond to that testosterone, right? And the thing is, testosterone controls your pubic and axillary hair. If you have bad, like underdeveloped pubic and axillary hair on an MBM exam, then you definitely should be thinking about AIS, right? So you may say, okay, Divine, why do they have like no uterus, no ovaries, no upper vagina? Well, that's pretty easy, right? So remember those tests, because these people are males, they are 46XY. So they have testicles, right? So those testicles contain Sertoli cells. Those Sertoli cells, they make anti-Mullerian hormone. Remember, sometimes it's called Mullerian inhibiting factor, or sometimes it's called Mullerian inhibiting hormone. So those things prevent the formation of the Mullerian duct. So everything that's a derivative of the Mullerian duct does not form. So the fallopian tubes won't form, the uterus won't form, and the upper vagina won't form. Remember, the ovary is not derived from the Mullerian duct. That's extremely high yield to know. The ovary is not derived from the Mullerian duct. Okay? So that's how you diagnose AIS, right? And again, people that have AIS, essentially, they're going to have low levels of FSH and LH, right? They're going to have low levels of FSH and LH because that testosterone that's not able to act on its receptor, right? Again, they're not really going to, like that excess testosterone they have that doesn't act on the androgen receptor in the periphery, well, it's going to, in a sense, let me come back a bit here. So the androgen receptor doesn't work, right? And remember, the androgen receptors in the periphery, but they also androgen receptors in the brain, right? Like, for example, we know for sure that, testosterone can have some brain-like effects, right? So the androgen receptors in the brain actually still don't work. But remember, these people, they have this enzyme known as aromatase, right? They have normal aromatase activity. So aromatase can convert those androgens, that testosterone, to estrogen. And then that estrogen can exert negative feedback at the level of the anterior pituitary. So these people are going to have low FSH and LH. This is actually high yield to know. People that have androgen insensitivity syndrome are going to have low FSH and low LH. Okay? Low FSH and low LH. And again, because again, they have this aromatase business taking testosterone to estrogen, that's why they're able to have great breasts, right? They're able to have great breasts as a result of that. And then what if they give you a question about a person, you know, they tell you that this woman is a female, she has never had menses, she's 19 years old. And then they tell you in the question that she has, she has normal breasts, so like Tanner 5 breasts. She has great pubic and axillary hair, Tanner 5. So but you notice that she has never had a menses, and they tell you that, oh, the vagina ends in a blind pouch, and you do a transvaginal ultrasound, you see no uterus. Right? So right off the bat, if you see that she has good pubic and axillary hair, that should help you exclude androgen insensitivity syndrome, right? Because if you have androgen insensitivity syndrome, that's going to, you're not going to have good pubic, you'll have underdeveloped pubic and axillary hair, right? So the fact that she has good pubic and axillary hair tells you that the testosterone is working. And the fact that she has great breasts tells you that she has estrogen around, right? So she has ovaries. So whenever you see stuff like this, where the person is pretty much normal, but they just don't have upper vaginas and a uterus, then you want to think about something called Mullerian agenesis, right? You want to think about Mullerian agenesis. So remember, Mullerian agenesis, sometimes on exams, is called MRKH syndrome, right? So Meyer-Rokitansky-Kosterhauser syndrome, okay? Meyer-Rokitansky-Kosterhauser syndrome. And again, because these people have normal regulation of everything, their ovaries are fine, making testosterone normally, making estrogen normally. Remember, estrogen is made by the granulosa cells, and then testosterone is made by the thicker cells. That estrogen is going to regulate the FSH-LH normally, right? So their FSH and LH will be normal, right? Again, the reason I'm emphasizing these values is your friends at the MBM, they're pretty smart, right? So they love to occasionally give these questions, and then they can try to see if you can differentiate between two or three different pathologies by the FSH and LH levels. Again, that's what I'm trying to explain pathophys. Most of these things you don't have to memorize. They just make sense, right? Okay, what if they give you a question about a patient, and they tell you that, oh, this patient has a history of... She has a history of like some pelvic malignancy. She has undergone radiation therapy like 3-4 years ago. And then since then, she has been amenorrheic, right? If you see that, I would really hope that you're thinking about like ovarian failure, right? Think about ovarian failure. Remember, ovarian failure is something that can happen because the ovaries, whenever you have a cell that is rapidly dividing, is not going to be very happy when you subject it to radiation or chemo. I mean, think about it. When people have cancer, why do you think their hair kind of falls off a lot? Why do you think they have a lot of GI problems? Because those are rapidly dividing cells, right? So your ovaries, at least if you're a woman that has reproductive potential, those ovaries are contain a lot of rapidly dividing cells, right? So the thing that's going to happen is if you subject the woman to like chemotherapy or radiation therapy, that can cause the ovaries to fail, right? And again, if the ovaries fail, unfortunately, you are not going to be making any estrogen anymore. If you're not making any estrogen, then your FSH and your LH will be normal. I mean, sorry, will be increased because there's no more negative feedback from that estrogen, okay? So again, just one of these things that are very high yield to know for purposes of exams. And then, what if they give you a question about a 30-year-old female? They tell you that she has a history of like Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And then they tell you that over the past year, she has been trying to have a child with her husband. And she's not able to. And they tell you that her Hashimoto's is well controlled with levothyroxine. In fact, they will give you thyroid hormone labs and they'll be normal. And then they'll say which of the following is the most likely etiology of the patient's presentation. And they will try to trick you into picking hypothyroidism as the cause. But notice all I've given you in this Q-stem literally tells you that good control, right? So if they are telling you something in an MBME question, stop arguing with the MBME. They're not trying to trick you, okay? Stop arguing with them. Again, they're the ones that literally control your scores. Whatever they tell you, just take it down and say yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and move right along, okay? So essentially, when you see a person before the age of 40, and you notice that these people, they're beginning to have like no menses, and they're having trouble conceiving. And then in the question, they can even tell you that their FSH is elevated and they have a history of like an autoimmune disease. Then I really want you to think about premature ovarian failure, right? Remember, many times people that have premature ovarian failure, they get that because they have like some autoimmune attack of their ovaries, right? And remember, many times on MBM exams, as a general principle, when they want to give you a question that has an autoimmune disease as an answer, they will give you the person having a past medical history of another autoimmune disease. So obviously, if a person has premature ovarian failure, remember again the diagnostic criteria. This is a person where they pretty much stop having their periods before the age of 40, right? And you notice that their FSH, LH is elevated, right? So if you see that, I want you to think about premature ovarian failure, right? Premature ovarian failure. And again, because the ovaries have failed, no more estrogen, right? So your FSH and your LH are going to be elevated, okay? Your FSH, LH are going to be elevated. Okay, what if they give you a question about 19-year-old female, they tell you that she's a competitive Olympic athlete and she has been having trouble conceiving and she has not had a period for the last 7 months, right? What's your diagnosis there? Well, I would really hope you're thinking about athletic amenorrhea, right? You're thinking about athletic amenorrhea. So remember, whenever you, and let's say a BMI is like 18 or, you know, super slender BMI. Well, the problem is whenever you don't have adequate nutrition, your levels of a hormone known as ghrelin go up, right? Your levels of ghrelin, G-H-R-E-L-I-N, go up. And when your ghrelin goes up, that actually shuts down the production of GnRH, right? Ghrelin is a very powerful inhibitor of GnRH secretion. So guess what? If your ghrelin is high because you're grueling with hunger, right? Then you're going to shut down GnRH. If your GnRH is low, then your FSH and LH will both be low, right? And then your estrogen will obviously be low. So if you notice in this case, this person's gonadotropins are low, but the estrogen is low as well, right? So this will be a very good, nice, handy-dandy example of hypogonadotropic, right? Hypogonadism, okay? Another thing, and again, obviously, this person just needs to start eating, get to a healthy BMI, and their situation will largely, for the most part, resolve, right? And then also remember, if a person has, they can give you a question about a person that has, like, bitemporal hemianopsia, and again, they're infertile, right? Again, in those circumstances, please think about hyperprolactinemia, right? So they have like a prolactinoma that's compressing the optic chiasm, and that's causing that tunnel vision. But in addition to that, prolactin is a very powerful inhibitor of GnRH. So if you inhibit GnRH, again, your FSH LH will be low, your estrogen will be low, and you'll be amenorrheic. Okay, so that's another example. So prolactinoma causes a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Remember, those people have like galactorrhea and gynecomastia, and you can treat them with a dopamine agonist like bromocriptine or cabergoline, right? And then what if a person, if they give you a question about a patient, you know, 33-year-old female, for the past year she's unable to have kids, and then they tell you that they give you like some labs, you notice her vitals, her heart rate is 56, she has like decreased deep tendon reflexes, has like a non-pedian edema of the lower extremities. If you see that, right, you should want to think about hypothyroidism, right? Remember, when you're hypothyroid, that's going to make your TRH high, right? And remember, another name for thyrotropin releasing hormone is prolactin releasing factor. So if your prolactin is then increased as a result of that, so literally hypothyroidism causes hyperprolactinemia, right? So your prolactin is high. If your prolactin is high, that's going to kill your GnRH. If your GnRH gets killed, then you're going to be amenorrheic, right? So again, hypothyroidism can cause a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. I mean, what if they give you another question about a patient that has chronic malabsorption and they're infertile, and they tell you that, you know, this person has recurrent infections, right? Like recurrent upper respiratory infections. That's obviously going to be cystic fibrosis, right? And cystic fibrosis, again, basically the guy and the gal that have cystic fibrosis will be infertile, right? For the guy's case, his vas deferens is not there, right? You have agenesis of the vas deferens. That's going to cause problems. For the lady in that case, she has like, remember, people that have CF, they have very thick secretions, right? So her vaginal secretions will be like super, super thick. So because her vaginal secretions are literally super, super thick, she's not going to be able to let sperm in, right? So she's going to be infertile in those circumstances. And you may be like, Divine, why does this person have malabsorption? Well, think about it. If a person has CF, their pancreatic duct is all gunked up with like just nasty goopies, like very thick secretions, right? So they're not going to be able to put lipase in the GI tract. So they're not going to be able to break down fat. So you're going to have a lot of fat malabsorption, right? Now, what if they literally give you an identical presentation to what I said, right? Infertility, fat malabsorption, but you don't see all the stuff with recurring upper respiratory infections. And they tell you that, oh, the person's symptoms resolve whenever she goes on a new diet or whatever. If you see that, that's going to be celiac disease, right? Celiac disease is just almost like a malabsorptive cause of athletic amenorrhea, right? Because think about it. If you have celiac disease, you've killed your microvilli in your small intestine, right? So you're not going to be able to reabsorb anything. So people that have celiac disease, they tend to be like, have like really bad malnutrition. Well, if you're malnourished, well, guess what? Your ghrelin, again, is going to be really high. If your ghrelin is high, that's going to kill GnRH. So you're going to have a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Okay? Hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. And then don't forget, people that are on antipsychotics, right? So what do antipsychotics love to do to people, right? So remember, antipsychotics, they block dopamine receptors. Well, one area where they block dopamine receptors is in the tuberoinfundibular pathway, right? So remember, another name for dopamine is prolactin inhibiting factor. So if you block dopamine receptors, you're actually going to have an upregulation of prolactin, especially in people that are taking risperidone, right? So if you do that, your prolactin will go up, your GnRH will go down, your FSH LH will go down, right? Your estrogen will go down, right? So ultimately, again, that will lead to a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, right? Another classic one they can give you, again, they can even give you a person being treated for diabetic gastroparesis that develops amenorrhea. Again, the thinking there is very easy. Again, we treat diabetic gastroparesis with metoclopramide. Metoclopramide is a dopamine receptor antagonist, blocks the dopamine receptor that will cause hyperprolactinemia, and then that will kill GnRH, and then you have a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, okay? Another one they can give you is a person that is hirsute, right? And is infertile, right? That's obviously going to be PCOS, right? That's going to be PCOS. Remember, people that have PCOS, right? They tend to have like very high levels of LH, and their LH to FSH ratio tends to be increased. Although remember, that's not part of the diagnostic criteria, right? But the thing with people that have PCOS is they never ovulate, right? Literally, another name for PCOS is like anovulation, right? So if you don't ovulate, well, you're not going to ever make progestin, right? So the uterus is never going to be ready to properly take care of a of an implanted embryo or whatever, right? And also, you're literally, if you're not ovulating, you're literally not releasing any eggs. It's not like the sperm can like do like this merry-go-round and make its way to the ovaries, right? So in that case, right, again, PCOS, remember, they'll have like an ovulation, they'll have signs of hyperandrogenism, right? And then they'll have polycystic ovaries on ultrasound. And remember, you just need two out of those three. You need to just basically check two of those three boxes, and then the person is good to go, right? Or what if they give you a question about a woman? They tell you that she delivered a kid 3 years ago, and that delivery of that kid was complicated by very major blood loss. And after she stopped breastfeeding, she has been trying with her husband to have new kids, and it's not working out. But if you see stuff like that, then I want you to think about Sheehan syndrome, right? So just backtrack to her delivery. She delivered, she bled out a ton. Remember, when a woman is pregnant, she has like, it's like hormone central. Just like a ton of hormone going around. Well, that hormone's got to come from somewhere. In this case, it's the anterior pituitary. So the anterior pituitary gets huge during pregnancy, right? So the thing that can happen with the anterior pituitary is it can pretty much... it's very susceptible to ischemia because it's now very big, very vascular. So if a person bleeds out a lot in pregnancy, they can pretty much have an ischemic stroke of the anterior pituitary, and that will cause Sheehan syndrome, right? So those people would not be able to make FSH and LH, right? No FSH, no LH, right? But their GnRH should technically be big enough, right? I mean, it should be high because you're not getting FSH, you're not getting LH, so no estrogen, so there's no negative feedback, right? But the anterior pituitary is literally gone, so you're not going to be making any FSH or LH, right? So in that case, people that have Sheehan syndrome, right, their FSH and LH will be decreased, okay? Their FSH and LH will be decreased. And then remember, if they give you a question about a patient, and they tell you that, you know, it's like a 17-year-old girl, never had menses, but they tell you some story about how she has like cyclical abdominal pain at the end of every month. You want to think about an imperforate hymen, right? They can even tell you that you see a blue bulge in the vagina when you do like a vaginal exam. You want to think about imperforate hymen. Sometimes they may call this like a transverse vaginal septum. But basically, you treat that with surgery. You just do a crochet incision and boom, you pop out all that old tissue and the woman should be fine. You pretty much cure her. But one thing that will tell you that you're dealing with imperforate hymen or transverse vaginal septum is that the FSH and LH will be normal, okay? The FSH and LH will be normal. Another thing they can also do to you on an exam is they can tell you something about a woman that has had PID many times or multiple abortions with a ton of DNCs, right? And then they tell you that, oh, she's now married, trying to have kids, having a lot of issues. Well, you want to think about Asherman syndrome, right? Remember, another name for Asherman syndrome is uterine synecdoche. Synecdoche is S-Y-N-E-C-H-I-E-E, right? Sometimes they even call it uterine adhesion disease, right? So they have a ton of adhesions in the uterus. Basically, when you keep scrubbing, like you do a ton of abortions, have a ton of PID, you keep scraping the endometrial lining. Well, unfortunately, at some point, you may go ahead and scrape the decidua basalis, right? So those stem cells that kind of support the uterus, the endometrial lining. So if those are gone, well, doesn't matter how much estrogen you have or how much progesterone you have, there's no stem cell to make those endometrial lining cells in the first place. So the person's kind of screwed. So those people actually, their FSH, LH, estrogen, everything will be all normal, right? Because there's just no place for the estrogen, progesterone is around, but it's just not able to accomplish any goal. So I'm just trying to like juggle in my memory if there are any other like high yield pathologies I have not mentioned with regards to causes of amenorrhea. We can give you a question about a woman, right? So 38-year-old female, tell you that she has a history of Prinzmetal's medal angina, right? And then they tell you that she was starting a new drug, right? And then now she's having amenorrhea, right? Again, if you think of it, when people have Prinzmetal's angina, again, remember these days it's called a variant angina. It's called variant angina. That variant angina, essentially, you can treat it with a non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blocker, right? So something like verapamil or diltiazem. Remember, verapamil is very, very excellent at causing hyperprolactinemia, but it causes an increased release of prolactin. So again, that will kill GnRH, kill FSH, LH, kill estrogen, so you have a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism, right? And then remember that if you breastfeeding, right? I mean, for you to breastfeed, you literally need prolactin around. That high prolactin, at least for the first 6 months after you deliver, can really help with killing GnRH, killing FSHLH, right? So you don't have any menses. It's almost like the body was designed to like, okay, you know what, let's try to not get pregnant again so that we can actually take care of this new baby that came like, you know, like 6 months ago. And then one thing I think I wanna mention here is if a woman of reproductive potential presents with amenorrhea, always get a pregnancy test, right? Always get a pregnancy test, because remember, again, pregnancy is the most common cause of secondary amenorrhea, okay? Pregnancy is the most common cause of secondary amenorrhea. Even if it's like a 14-year-old kid, just get the pregnancy test. Even if they've never had menses before, they may have had sex like when they were about to pop out their first eggs, okay? Just one of these weird, bizarre things that your friends at the MBME sort of kind of expect you to know, okay? They expect you to know, right? And again, some other like weird stuff that can cause amenorrhea. If a person has aromatase deficiency, right? A person that has aromatase deficiency, they won't be able to make estrogen from their androgens, right? Remember, there's this two-cell theory for how estrogen is made in the ovaries, right? So the thecal cells will make testosterone. Remember the teen, theca for teen testosterone, right? So the theca cells will make testosterone, but oh, there's no aromatase. Oops. So because they have no aromatase, the granulosa cells will not be able to aromatize that testosterone to make estrogen, right? So if you're not making estrogen, yikes. Those people, unfortunately, they're going to go ahead and have low estrogen, so their GnRH, FSHLH will be elevated, right? So they'll have a hypergonadotropic hypogonadism. Remember, they give you a person that has amenorrhea, can't smell a thing, right? You want to think about Common syndrome, right? So Common syndrome, those GnRH producing neurons, they migrate well in embryology, right? And also your olfactory, your cranial nerve 1 neuron. So if that's the case, again, your GnRH is going to be low, your FSHLH will be low, your estrogen will be low, right? So you're going to have a hypogonadotropic hypogonadism. Okay. And then remember that, I think I've mentioned that already. Okay. So I think I've pretty much talked about all the common causes. I mean, like, again, I will not be surprised if you get like, at least if you're taking a step one, step two, CK, or step three exam, like two or three questions from this podcast, if not more, right? And if you're studying for your OB-GYN shelf exam, this is definitely a podcast you should, you know, sort of kind of listen to, because you're going to get tons and tons and tons of amenorrhea questions on your exam. And as I wrap up today, please subscribe to the podcast. Again, I have this on Apple Podcasts, on Google Podcasts, and on Spotify. And I have a YouTube channel, Divine Intervention, USMLE Podcasts and Videos. So please subscribe to that. And then also, if you want to get all my, you know, a notification whenever I, you know, make a podcast, just sign up on the website, divineinterventionpodcast.com. And again, common thing I get from people, they say, oh, Divine, on Apple Podcasts, I did not find episode 2 or 3 or whatever, right? Again, remember, I promise it's literally out of my hands, but WordPress has a rule and is also kind of like, it's kind of a WordPress rule. You pretty much can't get more than 150. Essentially, the most recent 150 podcasts will be the things that will show up on Apple Podcasts, right? So basically, this is episode 278. So after this is uploaded, the first, like, if I'm doing my math correctly, so 150 minus 278 is 128, right? So you would not see the first 128 to 135 podcasts, because there are some announcement podcasts I've made along the way, right? And then I do offer one-on-one tutoring for the USMLE exams. So step one, step two, CK, step three, preclinical exams, third year shelf exams, offer tutoring for all those things. And again, if you're a medicine resident, actually tutor for the medicine boards and the medicine in training exam. And again, I've worked with thousands of students. I've had very successful students. You can look up the testimonials on my website. That's like a fraction of many of the very good testimonials I've had, even with the newer MBM exams that are a little more challenging for people. So if you failed a step one exam, failed a step two exam, failed a step three exam, I have a lot of success stories of people I've worked with that have failed the exam even multiple times. And then we worked together and, you know, thankfully to God, they ended up doing well. And then, as you saw, like maybe an hour or two ago, I uploaded a podcast on the course I'm going to be offering from the 6th to the 9th of January. So I'm offering the MBME test taking strategies class. It's 2.5 hours, and we'll basically teach you how to approach MBME questions. And then from the 7th to the 9th, the 10-hour course that I used to have before, I'm expanding it to be a 16.5-hour course, because I want to cover biostats, I want to cover ethics, I want to cover those healthcare systems things that came in November 2020. And also there's a bunch of high yield, like medicine, neuro, ped, surgery, OB-GYN, psych concepts that the MBME is beginning to care about these days that I also want to cover. So I'm expanding the course. So it's basically going to be 3 days from 11 a.m. to 4 30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on the 7th, the 8th, and the 9th. The Test Taking Strategies course is from 2 to 4:30 p.m. Mountain Standard Time on the 6th. So thank you for listening. I'll see you in the next podcast. Have a wonderful week ahead, and God bless you. Thank you.